Okay, first of all, Freilich and Chanukah, thank everybody for coming to our home for the shiur. I'm sorry we're not all in the same room, which is the only way we can set it up like this. Just for the sake of the recording, I'm going to say that tonight is the 21st of December, and it is a Chanukah shiur. And here we have represented actually several different shiurim of mine. I invited different groups of shiurim and their spouses. So not everybody comes to every class, but we had a question that we left open-ended in our Sunday night class, which we will attempt to answer this evening, which has to do with Chanukah. And that is that we know that Yaakov went back for Pachim Ketanim. Yaakov went back for small flasks, and what was that all about? What are those small flasks? What's it all about? We're going to answer that tonight, and I will explain that a little bit better for those who are not familiar. So let me just give you an idea of what's going to happen. Tonight's Chanukah class is one like none other than you've ever heard. This is going to go way off into areas of the stratosphere that are not going to immediately seem to deal with Chanukah. But as we move along, we will eventually get back to Chanukah. There are going to be five pieces of introductory material. And then we'll finally put all five pieces together, which will bring in Chanukah. So we have to follow along with five different pieces. Two are going to be from the Chumash, two from the Nevi'im, from the prophets, which are Haftorahs, and the fifth one will be a Medrash. That's what we're going to deal with. I'm going to see if I can... I just don't want to have to carry this thing around. Hopefully this will work. What's that? No, it has a clip, right? It has a clip. Let's see if this will work like this. Okay. Now, we know, and for those who come to Sunday night's class, this is going to be a little repetitious, but let's get everybody on the same page. We know that Yaakov, when he prepared to meet Esav in Parshas Vayishlach, he prepared in three ways. What are the three ways he prepared? Okay, he prayed. He sent gifts. And he prepared for war by splitting the camps. He split his camp into two. That's how he prepared for war. So we know that. We know then that after all that happened, he began to move everybody along. We talked about in our class, we talked about why he moved them, where he moved them to, crossing the river Yabok. And he then had to go back. It says, Vayivaser Yaakov Levado. Yaakov was left alone. And that's where he went back for those few flasks. He had moved everything he owned across the river, and then he came back for those small flasks, Pachim Ketanim. And over there, it says that he had a battle with a certain man. And this man turns out to be who? Okay, it's the Sar of Esav, the angel of Esav. And he has a battle with the Esav angel, and it lasts
all night.
And at the end of the night, who wins? Yaakov wins. And that's the end of that. He wins the battle with Esav's Malach, with Esav's angel. Then, the very next episode is that Esav and Yaakov actually meet. And when Esav and Yaakov actually meet, they meet, and Yaakov has his four wives and 11 sons. Binyamin is not yet born. And they're all lined up, and they bow to Esav. And the question we ask is that the camps were no longer split. He had split the camps in anticipation of the battle with Esav. And here, when he actually meets Esav, they're all together, one big happy family. They're not two camps. So what happened that seems to have removed the need to have these camps split? And the answer can only be...
He must have thought it was safe.
Why would he think it was safe? It wasn't safe in the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach. That was later. What?
He won the battle.
Right. Since he wins the battle with the angel of Esav, then he realizes that the coast is clear. Once he wins that battle, the war is over. So now he's not afraid anymore of Esav, and he can have both his families can be all together. He doesn't need two camps anymore when he actually meets up with Esav. You have a question?
Did he know that it was the angel?
Yeah, he knows that. So, therefore, everything is fine at that point. So this battle with the angel of Esav was the thing that ended the threat. Then now he could be altogether. When this happens, that means that the angel of Esav attacks him when he's vulnerable, when he goes back for those pachim ketanim, for those small flasks. And when he wins, then he's safe. So what we have to understand is, why did the angel of Esav attack him at that time? It's true he was left alone, which means he was vulnerable. What happened particularly with those small flasks? It seems that somehow those pachim ketanim, those are the things that triggered Esav's angel's attack on Yaakov. And when Yaakov finally won, that was finally the end of the battle, and now he was safe from Esav. What happened over there with those pachim ketanim? Now, earlier, this all happens when Yaakov is returning from Lavan's house, and he's meeting up with Esav. But earlier, in the beginning of Parashas Vayetze, when Yaakov is leaving to go to Lavan's house, we know that he went, and the pasuk tells us, Vayitka b'makom, that he ended up going to sleep on what would eventually be the Temple Mount, the Har HaMoriah, and he has a dream, that's the famous dream with the ladder with the angels going up and down. Now, he wakes up in the morning, and he realizes that this has been a very important dream, and he's in a very important place, and he takes the stone that he had put around his head, and he makes it into a matzeva, which means a monument. Okay, and what does he do with it?
He pours oil on it.
Now there's a problem here. We also know that when Yaakov finally gets to Laban's house, he's penniless, even though he was a very wealthy man. Why was he penniless when he got to Laban's house? Okay, because Esav had sent his son Eliphaz to kill Yaakov. And when Eliphaz got to Yaakov, he was going to kill him. But then because Eliphaz had grown up, as Rashi says, on the lap of Yitzchak, so he couldn't do it. He didn't want to kill Yaakov. But he said to Yaakov, what am I going to do about my father's command to kill you? So Yaakov said to him, you know what you should do? Take my money. Because if you take my money, a poor person is in Tachashuv Kemes, is considered like he's dead. And therefore, in some measure, you will have fulfilled your father's command. So, you can take everything I have. And we know that when Yaakov got to Laban's house, he had nothing but the shirt on his back. He was completely penniless, had absolutely nothing to his name. Because Eliphaz had taken everything. So the question is, if Eliphaz had taken everything, then where did Yaakov get the oil to pour on this monument? When he wakes up in the morning, takes the stone, and then he pours the oil on the monument. What oil? Where did he get it from? He didn't have anything left. It was all taken. Eliphaz wouldn't have left him with a flask of oil. That is piece of information number two. So number one, we have that Yaakov had gone back for these small pachim, these small flasks, and that seems to have precipitated the attack of the angel of Esav, which then, when Yaakov wins that, he's in the clear. And we also have this curiosity of where the oil came from that Yaakov used to put on the monument in the beginning of Parshas Vayetze. Those are two pieces of information. Now we move on to two other important pieces of information from Navi, from the prophets. The first comes from the Navi Ovadia. Now Ovadia is a prophet, and Ovadia is one of Treyasar. He is one of the 12 smaller sized prophets. And Ovadia is one of the smallest of the small sized prophets. How many chapters in the book of Ovadia?
One.
One chapter in the book of Ovadia. I love to tell my kids, you know what chapter it's in? I like to quote them right away. It's in chapter 1 of Ovadia. Right. So Ovadia has one. Now, Ovadia is the Haftorah for Parshas Vayishlach. Parshas Vayishlach, we read all about Yaakov and Esav. The Haftorah for Parshas Vayishlach is the one chapter of Ovadia. And it's all about the downfall of Esav. That's what it's about, which is what you would expect. If you're reading about an Haftorah of Parshas Vayishlach, you'd expect it to be about the downfall of Esav. How eventually, eventually we will defeat the children of Esav, and Mashiach will come, etc. Now, Ovadia Chazal tell us, was himself a ger. He was a convert. Now this is strange, because typically a ger, a convert, can't be a prophet. A descendant of gerim could be a prophet, but the ger himself typically can't be a convert. It's an unusual thing. We don't find that anywhere else. But here Ovadia, who was a convert, he himself was a Navi. And Chazal tell us, why would he be a Navi? What happened that would make him a Navi? So Chazal tell us, because Ovadia is a ger Edomi. He is a convert from Esav. He's a descendant of Esav. He comes from Edom, which is Esav. And he converted and became a Jew. So Chazal say that Hashem says to Esav, I'm going to bring your downfall, minei ubei, from within you. I'm going to take one of your own, and that person who's going to become a Jew and is going to become a Navi, a prophet, that's the person who's going to say the prophecy about your eventual downfall. I'm going to bring your defeat from within yourself. That's why Ovadia was a Navi, and he was the one who says that very important prophecy about the downfall of Esau. But Chazal says something else about why Ovadia is the one who says the prophecy against Edom, against Esau. See, Ovadia lived in the time of Achav and, what's his wife's name? Izebel, who were an evil king and queen. Of which kingdom? Yehuda. Not Yehuda. Of Yisrael. The northern kingdom. The northern kingdom. They are the king and queen of the northern kingdom. Who was the prophet, the Navi, in the time of Achab and Izebel, the head prophet? Not Elisha. Eliyahu, a Navi, he prophesied at the time of Achab and Izebel. So at that time, Ovadia was the head of the household of Achav and Izebel. He ran the palace. He was the chief of staff. Right? He was the one who ran the palace. And the Navi tells us that Ovadia had the distinction of being Yarei Es Hashem Me'od. He feared God very much. Ovadia was known to be a person who feared God in a very, very great way. So, Chazal say, our sages teach us, that Ovadia will come, who lived amongst two evil people, Achav and Izebel, and didn't learn from their ways. He himself was righteous. So he who lived amongst two evil people, Achab and Izebel, and did not learn from their ways, and he remained righteous, not just remained righteous, he was exceedingly righteous. He will come and say the prophecy against Esav, who grew up amongst two very righteous people. Who are the two righteous people he grew up with? Yitzchak and Rivka, his parents. And he didn't learn from their ways. So Esav, who didn't learn from the ways of the righteous, who he grew up with, the prophecy will come against him from Ovadia, who lived amongst two evil people, Achav and Izebel, and he didn't learn from their ways. That's the midah keneged midah, the measure for measure, in the eventual destruction of Esav. So that is piece of information number 3. It's that Ovadia is the one who says prophecy against Esav, and it's because he comes from Esav and because he grew up amongst two evil people. Now, for the fourth piece of information, this is the longest of the stories we have to be informed of tonight. Some of you may be familiar with these stories already. But this takes us back to the Haftorah of Parashas Vayera. In the Haftorah of Parashas Vayera, now in Vayera, you know that's where the angels came and informed Sarah that she would have a baby. So the Haftorah mimics the Parsha. And in the Haftorah we have someone else who informs a barren woman that she will have a baby. Who informs a barren woman that she'll have a baby? Well, that's in the Parsha. Not Eliyahu. Elisha. The prophet Elisha, not the Navi Elisha, who is a man. The prophet Elisha he informs the Shunamis, a woman, that she will have a baby. And that's why that Haftarah is read in Parashas Vayera. Now, Elisha is the student of who? Of Eliyahu. He's the next generation. Eliyahu was the head prophet in his time. And when Eliyahu ascended to the heavens, Elisha, who was his primary student, became the primary prophet. So Elisha then has a bunch of different stories that happen with him. So the Haftarah that we read is all about how he has this prophecy about this woman who's going to have a baby, and then you know, the baby gets older, becomes a young man, he dies, Elisha goes and brings the baby back, brings the young man back to life. That's the Haftarah. There's a curiosity, because when we read the Haftarah actually begins with a different story. And the story it begins with seems to have nothing to do with the story of Elisha and the Shunamis, and the baby was going to be born and brought back to life and all that. It's just a whole different story. What's the whole different story? It starts off, it's about, I don't know, 7-8 psukim in the beginning of the Haftarah, with Elisha being called upon for help by, it says, Isha Achas Minashay V'nei HaNeviyim, a woman who was from the wives of the prophets. And she comes to Elisha and she says, my husband, your servant, has died. That's her husband, who was a prophet, had died. And he left a huge amount of debt. And now the creditor is coming and demanding I pay up. I have nothing to pay with. And he's going to take my two sons as slaves to pay up my debt. So Elisha says to her, what do you have in the house? So she says, I have nothing in the house except one flask of oil, a such shaman, one flask of oil. So Elisha tells her, go borrow utensils from all the neighbors, as many utensils as you can, and fill up your house with utensils, and then you'll begin pouring that flask of oil. Don't move the flask, because this flask is going to become like a well, like a spring. Don't move the flask, leave it where it is, and continually move utensils underneath the flow of oil. As you pour, you'll fill up one container, move that container aside, bring another container. Move that container aside, bring another container. And a miracle will take place. The oil will keep on flowing until every container is filled with oil. And that's what she does with her sons. They close the door behind them, and they do this miracle. And every single utensil gets filled with oil. Simultaneously, the price of oil skyrockets. This is not the first time. The price of oil skyrockets. $500 a barrel. And it's a different kind of oil. Olive oil. Skyrockets. And she becomes a very, very wealthy woman. Now, and that saves her, because she has enough money now to pay off her debts and to live off of. She comes to Elisha and she says, what should I do now? She doesn't know whether she should sell the oil. It's interesting. You think that stockbrokers, this is the first instance of stockbrokers, she goes to Elisha to find out whether she should sell the oil now or should she wait for the price to go up higher. That's what Rashi says. So she goes and she asks Elisha, what should I do? Elisha says, sell. So she goes and she sells the oil. Elisha says to her, sell it now, but when you sell it now, you'll have enough money to pay off your debts and to live. But here a very curious thing happens. Rashi says, you'll have enough money to live ad sheyachayu hamesim, until the dead are resurrected. That's what Rashi says. Very interesting. Why? Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that there's descendants of that woman today who are still living off of that money? I'd like to raise some money from them. Where is that? I don't know what that means. You'll have enough money to live until the dead are resurrected. So I'm not sure we'll be able to understand that fully, but we will have an insight into that.
Called billions.
Okay.
It's not the next story.
What's the next story? Yeah, the next story is the story of Elisha going and predicting the birth of this.
That's when the money runs out.
Well, but it's not her. It's somebody else entirely. So I don't know what that means.
Her dead?
Not her dead. No, it's somebody else.
No, but the prophecy is for her own dead, you're saying.
I don't know. It just says, till the dead are resurrected.
Yeah, but
Would that be one of these, except, you know, like when they say seven, it doesn't mean seven.
Yeah, I don't know what it means.
But this is that was the Vajra's widow.
Oh, so now, who is this woman? So, Mrs. Wittenberg has already told us. Yeah, you're right. So this woman, who is this woman whose husband has died? It is Ovadia's wife. Ovadia, that Navi, has died, and it's his sons who are going to be taken as slaves, because there's a huge debt. Now, why is there a huge debt? What did Ovadia do that cost so much money? So, we know from a previous story, see, Ovadia, as we already said, was the head of the house of Ahav and Izebel. Now, Ahav and Izebel were evil. Ahav was a tremendous idolater, but Izebel was worse than Ahav. Why was she worse than Ahav? What did she do? She had killed out all the prophets. She went on a rampage killing out prophets. When this happened, Ovadia took 100 prophets and hid them, 50 in one cave and 50 in another cave. And he hid the prophets and took care of them. He supported them. He brought them food and water, etc. Took care of them until things calmed down and they could be saved. So he single-handedly saved 100 prophets. That's what he did. That was part of how we know how much he feared Hashem. But in order for Ovadia to do that, imagine taking in 100 people who need your support. How are you going to do that?
Lots of lakas.
That's right. You got to borrow money. So he had to borrow money. Who did he borrow money from?
It was the son of,
Ahav. The crown prince. He went to Yehoram ben Ahav, Yehoram the son of Ahav, and he borrowed money from Yehoram the son of Ahav with interest. Now, that should set off an alarm in your head. Yehoram was a Jew. Was he allowed to do that? No. You're not allowed to lend with interest, nor can you borrow from another Jew with interest. But here it was to save people's lives. So Ovadia was allowed to borrow with interest, but Yehoram did a terrible sin by lending with interest. Because of that, when Yehoram is killed later on, it says that he got killed between his arms. And the reason why his arms are mentioned is because he reached with his arms to take the profit, to take the interest. And so that's how he was punished. So Yehoram, the son of Ahav, is the one who lent the money to Ovadia. Ovadia has now passed away, and it is Yehoram, the son of Ahav, who is coming to take Ovadia's sons as slaves. And so now it's the next generation. So now it's no longer Eliyahu who's the prophet, it's Elisha who's the prophet, and Ovadia's wife comes to Elisha and asks for help, and that's where the whole story with the oil takes place. Just as an aside, the Chafetz Chaim mentions this, it's important for us to note it, that we know that the generation of Ahav were terrible people. They were idolaters. The generation of David HaMelech, King David, were very, very righteous. Yet, we find that King David did not win all of his wars. There were some that he lost. While Ahav never lost the war. Every war he waged, he won. And Chazal say, why is that? So Chazal say, because in David HaMelech's time, King David's time, they were very righteous, but they were not perfect with their tongues. They weren't perfect with Lashon Hara. They did slip up now and then, speaking Lashon Hara. But in Ahav's day, they were perfect in one area, and that is they didn't speak Lashon Hara. And the power of speech is so strong that even though they were idolaters, it protected them in war. Not speaking Lashon Hara puts a shield of protection over the people. And even though they were not really righteous, it saved them from being defeated in war. How do we know they did not speak Lashon Hara in the day of Ahav? How do we know they didn't speak Lashon Hara? Where does it tell us they didn't speak Lashon Hara? The answer is that here you have a man, Ovadia, who hid away 100 people and had to feed them. Now that means he had to go to the store and he had to buy food and he had to get water and he get whatever it is and clothing, whatever was needed. You don't think people figured it out? You don't think that someone realized what's going on? People realized, but nobody talked. Nobody talked about other people. They just didn't do it. So even though they were evil, but nobody gave him away, not because they liked him or not because they liked what he was doing, but because in that generation they didn't talk about others. They just didn't talk about other people. They didn't do it. That's how you know that in Ahav's generation they were careful with Lashon Hara. That's a side point, but it's an important point for us to bear in mind. You have a question?
What reason did Ovadia give the son of Ahav for borrowing money?
I don't know. I don't know what he's going to get. Yeah.
I've never heard before that there was a generation that actually never spoke
Lashon Hara. They were very careful. I know what it means, never. They were very careful with
Lashon Hara. Why didn't we continue when, first?
I don't know. The Chavetz Chaim brings this, he cites this, when he's trying to get people not to speak Lashon Hara, he brings this proof.
Only in this era?
I don't know. Only, it's one of the times they never spoke Lashon Hara. So, there's your story with Ovadia. And now Ovadia's sons, his wife, the oil, the prediction from Elisha that you'll have enough money to live until the dead are resurrected. And then, right away, the very next story is this whole story with how Elisha goes to this woman, a Shunamis. She doesn't have any children, predicts that she will have a child, child is born, child gets older, dies, and then is resurrected. So, that's your next piece of information. That's the story of Ovadia. Here's piece number 5, and then we're going to put it all together. We know that there are 4 primary galuyos, 4 primary exiles that we Jews went through and are going through. The first one was Babel, Babylonia. They destroyed the first Beis HaMikdash. Second one was Paras, Persia, who defeated Babel, and then they took over. Third one was Yavan, which is what we're celebrating tonight, was the defeat of Yavan, of the Misyavnim, the Greeks. That's the third exile, which took place during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. And finally, the fourth one, which is the one we're in the middle of now, is Edom, is the descendants of Esav. Now, these 4 exiles are alluded to in several places. There's a Medrash that says, all the way back in Parshas Bereishis, in fact, in the second pasuk in the Torah, everybody knows the first pasuk, Bereishis Bara Elokim Es Hashamayim Ves Haaretz. And in the second pasuk of the Torah, these 4 exiles are alluded to. It says, V'haaretz haisa sohu v'avohu v'choshech al pnei sahom. The land, the world, was tohu, which means desolate, nothingness. Bohu, which is another word for nothingness. Choshech means darkness. Al pnei sahom, on the face of the depths. That's what the pasuk says. The Medrash says, Tohu Zegalos Bavel. The word Tohu, which means nothingness, that refers to the Babylonian exile. Bohu Zegalos Paras. That refers to the Persian exile. Choshech, darkness, Zegalos Yavan. That's the Greek exile. Which now, you understand, makes a lot of sense, that what do? We light the menorah, which is light, which it corresponds or pushes off the darkness of Yavan. Yavan is compared to darkness. So it is a menorah that counteracts the darkness of Yavan. And then it says, and al pnei tahom, on the face of the depths, that is Edom. That's the one we're in the middle of now. The depths, it's deep, it's unending almost. You can't see the end of it, it's vast. That's what the Medrash says. Now there's a difficulty here. Because it's one thing to say that Tohu is Bavel. Tohu means nothingness, so Bavel is nothingness. Bohu is Paras, is Persia. Again, it's nothingness. Choshech, darkness, is Yavan, is the Greeks. Fine? Al Pnei Tahom is very difficult to understand. On the face of the depths. That refers to Edom, on the face of the depths. I understand to tell me Tahom, the depths, that's Edom. But on the face of the depths, Al Pnei Tahom, that doesn't stand alone. What's Al Pnei Tahom? You're telling me that Edom is compared to on the face of the depths. Well, you have to have another word there. There's a word missing. You can't just say it's on the face of the depths. You have to have something on the face of the depths if you're going to compare something to Edom. So it's clear from the Medrash that what Edom is, Yavan, the Greeks, are Choshech, are darkness. Edom is Choshech al Pnei Tahom. Edom is a repeat of the Greeks, Choshech, only much worse, much more, much broader, much deeper. It's the same darkness, but it's al Pnei Tahom. rests on the face of the depths. It doesn't stand alone. Edom really is the darkness of the Greeks, but exponentially greater or worse. That's what it is. Now, we know this to be true. We know that Greek culture, Roman culture, that's what Western man is all about, is the Greek and Roman cultures. Rome was a continuation of the Greek culture. This, really, we can spin off into a whole another discussion. I'm not going to take you all the way over there with the what the Greeks introduced, what the Romans introduced, etc. But they are essentially the Greek darkness only expanded in a way that is alpenate to home in the face of the depths. That's what Gullus Edom is. Now, if that's true, that will answer a very important point that relates to Hanukkah, which is the Gullus Bavel, the exile of Bavel, the Babylonian exile, it ended. Do we have a holiday celebrating the end of Gullus Bavel? No. The Persian exile, it ended also. Do we have a holiday celebrating the end of the Persian exile?
Sort of.
Purim doesn't really celebrate it, because Purim is really celebrating the downfall of Amalek. The Persians still stayed in control then. There's no celebration of the Persian downfall. Yet with the Greeks, we have a celebration tonight and the next 8 days about their downfall. Why do we need that? But the answer is because the Greek problem and how we defeated them is needed to be known, because the Roman problem is the same thing as the Greek problem, only much worse. And therefore, the way that we will eventually get out of this exile is directly related to how the Hashmonaim got us out of the Greek exile. For the Jewish people to be able to defeat the Roman exile, we need to study and understand how the Hashmonaim defeated the Greek exile. If there would not be a Hanukkah, we would be doomed to remain in this exile forever, because we wouldn't have the tools to get out of this one. Yavon was Choshech. The menorah defeats Yavon. Edom is Choshech al pnei tahom. It's Choshech only exponentially worse. Therefore, the way that you defeat Edom is you take the menorah of Hanukkah and you exponentially increase it. And in doing so, you defeat Edom. That's why we have a Hanukkah. Because it's essential for the eventual defeat of Edom and for our getting out of this exile. The Medrash tells us, the Zohar says, when Yaakov was standing there in Beis El with that monument, and he had to pour oil on it, where did he get the oil from? The Zohar says, that oil came down from Shamayim, came down from the heavens, and was given to Yaakov so that he could anoint that monument. And it was in a flask, and he poured it, and the flask remained full. Now, you're starting to see what happens. The Zohar says, when Yaakov went back for the pachim kitanim, for those small flasks, that oil was in those flasks. And later on, when the wife of Ovadia, the widow of Ovadia, says to Elisha, the only thing I have in my home is one flask of oil, it was the same flask of oil. That's what the Zohar says. He does not say, which would have really made it nice, that and the oil that the Hashmonaim found on Hanukkah was the same oil. He doesn't say that, although I wouldn't put it past. You know, could be. But he doesn't say that. But at any rate, it's the same oil all the way through.
He knew. So, the rabbi could go back to the oil. Must have known that that's the oil.
Yaakov. Went back for the oil. Oh, you mean Elisha.
Elisha.
I guess so. I don't know. He had a prophecy. No, no, he was a prophet. Yes.
Rabbi Waffenberg said that the oil came from the olive branch that the dove brought to Noah.
Very interesting.
And that's how it got to be there, that it was the actual original olive branch.
Okay, good, good, excellent. So now, here you have this oil. Now we know that if you're going to have a symbol of Hanukkah, oil is the symbol of Hanukkah. That's why there's a custom to eat latkes on Hanukkah, because it's made with oil. And sufganiyot, because they're made with oil, besides the lighting of the menorah with oil. That's the minhag on Hanukkah. Oil is how the miracle happened, and therefore that symbolizes Hanukkah. When Yaakov forgot the pachim ketanim, that's what happened, he forgot them. That was symbolic. Maisa avo simen labanim, and what our ancestors did, our forefathers did, that foreshadows what we're going to do. That was a simen, that was foreshadowing, that at some point later in history, the Jewish people would forget the oil. They would forget that which the oil represents. That means that the Jews would begin to be assimilated by the Greeks. They would become Syrian Greeks, the Misyavnim, and they would be drawn into that foreign culture. They would forget the purity of the oil. When Yaakov remembered the Pachim Ketanim and went back for them, that was symbolic of the fact that even though the Jews would forget about the purity of the oil at some later point in history, they would then remember and they would go back and purify themselves and evict the Greeks from their territory. It is at that point that the angel of Esav attacks. You understand why now? You see, as long as the Jews forget the oil, the angel of Esav is safe. Because that which will defeat the angel of Esav is the oil of Hanukkah, only exponentially greater. So if the Jews forgot the oil, then Edom, Esav, is safe. But when Yaakov remembers the oil and he goes back for it, the angel of Edom understands, I had better attack him now. Because now is when I'm in danger. Because if he gets a hold of that oil and brings it back, that means that the Jews will have the purity of the oil, and then they will have the tool that is necessary to defeat me. That's why the battle takes place at that moment. And that's when Yaakov does defeat the angel of Edom, which symbolizes that not only will we remember the oil, but after the long night of exile, we will take that oil and we will increase it exponentially so that we can also use it to defeat the angel of Esav himself, which has not happened yet. But that's what's being symbolized throughout that whole story. When each of the previous three exiles ended, they ended. That was it. But we know when this last one ends, the revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to be so great, Mashiach will come, and then we don't know the exact sequence of events, but eventually it's going to lead to this world reaching its fruition, its shlemus, and that will be followed by Tchiyas HaMesim, the resurrection of the dead. The Hanukkah story leads to the defeat of Edom, which then leads to Tchiyas HaMesim, the resurrection of the dead. That is why in the story with Ovadia's wife and Elisha, you go from the oil to the story of Tchiyas HaMesim, of the resurrection of the dead. And that's why Elisha says to her, you'll have enough money to live until the dead are resurrected. I don't know exactly what that means, but that's the connection. Because the oil, that's our Hanukkah clock, because the oil goes into the defeat of Esav, which is then Tchiyas HaMesim.
The resurrection of the dead, the metaphor for
the return of assimilated Jews, the identity crisis.
That it's no question that could be it. It's very possible.
The Jewish people are having, I mean, the purification is the return to.
That's very possible. That's very, very possible. You know, it's likely going to happen on many levels, and it could be we're experiencing some of it now. Very possible. So now, what we need to understand then is, without walking out of here, right now it's a nice putting together of various points. But all we're left with right now is that we know that Hanukkah has the seeds of how we can get out of our exile, and it has to do with the menorah. But now what? It's the first night of Hanukkah. We have 8 days now to work on whatever this point is that will lead us out of our current exile. So what should we do? What should we do that will get us out of the exile? That, what does it mean that the light of Hanukkah has the seeds to get out of this exile? So that's why we started, that's why we mentioned the whole story with Ovadia and who he was. And that's, we're going to end with this explanation. It's going to take a few minutes to do though. Moshe, can you refill it please? Thank you. So, so it's like this. The light of Hanukkah, the menorah, clearly the issue is purity. There was assimilation going on, and then they found the pure oil. We know that that or light, ora zu Torah. We know that that's Torah. We know the light is always symbolic of Torah. The Jews the Jews in the time of Hanukkah were becoming assimilated and becoming adulterated, and their Torah was not pure. But then the light of the menorah pushed away the darkness and brought back the purity. Today, in Golus Edom, we have a much greater threat to our purity than did our ancestors in the Hanukkah story. We live amongst the culture that we're in, and we are affected by that culture in a way that we almost, in many ways we see it, but in many ways we don't even see it. We don't even realize just how much we're affected by the fact that we're in this culture. And the light of the menorah has in it the power to push away this darkness. Then we can purify ourselves. But the problem is this. The problem is that if it took the Maccabees and the Hashmonaim to defeat the smaller darkness of the Yavanim, of the Greeks, how are we, who are certainly on a much lower level than the great Hashmonaim, how are we to defeat the even greater, exponentially greater darkness of Edom? Well, one answer is, we have Hanukkah. They didn't. They made Hanukkah. But we have them to draw from to then take it to the next level. But it's more than that. Remember what we said about Ovadia. Hashem says about Ovadia, Hashem says to Edom, I'm going to bring your defeat from within you. Ovadia, who comes from you, is going to defeat you. The Jewish people are going to defeat you, Edom, when they're in the middle of you. When they are sunk deep into your culture, from there, the Jewish people are going to defeat you. Right there in the middle, right under your nose. Just as Ovadia comes out of Edom and defeats Edom, we will come out of Edom and defeat Edom. Not from outside of Edom, but from within Edom, we will destroy him. But more than that, Hashem says about Ovadia, why Ovadia? Because Ovadia lived amongst two Rishaim and didn't learn from their actions. So he will defeat Esav, who lived amongst two Tzadikim and didn't learn from their actions. What does that mean? That means that Edom has the capacity to be unaffected by his surroundings. Esav can grow up in the home of Yitzchak and Rivka, and it can be as if he didn't know who they were. He can grow up in their home and you'd never know it. He can ignore all that Kedusha, all that holiness that he grew up in, goes right off his back, slips right off him. It's nothing. That's the capacity of Esav. Ovadia comes from Esav. So he can use that self-same trait, which Esav used so negatively, Ovadia can use it positively. Because he can be in the house of evil people, of Ahav and Izebel, and you wouldn't know it. He comes out shining bright. And Yare es Hashem Ma'od, one who fears Hashem very much. Because he has that same trait of Edom. The message to us is that here in the Edom culture, it is our job to learn from Edom. And in learning from Edom, we will defeat Edom. How do we learn from Edom? We learn from Edom not to be affected by Edom. That's what we learn from him. And then from within Edom, we can defeat Edom. As long as we are learning from him, we are exhibiting a Jewish trait, which is to learn from everybody, which is a Jewish trait. But when you're within Edom, that trait can be dangerous. In Edom, we have to be able to ignore him, to be as if we're not here, to be physically living here, but spiritually we're someplace else. We're not like the people around us. We have nothing to do with the people around us spiritually. We don't take their examples. We have to stand alone spiritually. And in doing so, we then ignite that menorah in a much greater way. And from within Edom, we defeat Edom. And let me give a couple of practical examples. Edom represents materialism in a way that it has never been seen before, never been thought of before. The world never viewed materialism the way it does today. There has never been a time in history when the focus of mankind is pursue pleasure. Avoid pain and pursue pleasure. It's never been as pervasive as this. Of course, everybody has always liked pleasure. But it's never been on this level. It's never been to the point where it is so materialistic. It's such an animalistic way where there's no sense of the sublime. Even the Greeks who did pursue pleasure as well, but there was something sublime about it. They were into the arts, they were into music, they were into things that were the materialism, but materialism that was close to spirituality. In the Roman culture, it's all about basic animalistic pleasures. It's nothing sublime about it. There's nothing nice about it. It's all about what can I get out of it. That's the culture that we live in, and that's the message we get all the time. The advertising industry is nothing but that, and the truth is the entire culture is like that. And we are affected by it. We'd like to think we're not so affected by it, but we really are. We really, really are. You go to Eretz Yisrael, and you go to Yerushalayim, and you see how some people live, and you say to yourself, wow, they can live like that. And they're happy. And we come here, and we need more. We need more. We can't live the way they live. Somebody told me recently that in the 1950s, the average American household had 4.7 kids. That's more than three more than now. Right now it's like 1.2 or something like that. At that time it was 4.7. The average home, think about this, was between 1,000 and 1,200 square feet. The entire home. Now I don't know what the size of these two rooms is, but I suspect it's pretty close. And well, they didn't have all that anything. They didn't have the clothes, the cars, etc. I mean, everything we have is... Right? That's not so long ago. We're talking 50 years ago. That's what it was. But today, You know, it's well, we're used to so much more. We are very, very into materialism. So what is the answer? Is the answer to throw out all of our materialism? At least we have to be aware of it, and we have to understand it cannot be the focus of our lives. It can't be what's important. It can't be the thing that we are pursuing. We have to be pursuing being close to Hashem. That's really the only thing that matters. That's what the light of Torah is to be close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what we're after. Not to be focused on Olam Hazeh, on this world, on materialism, which is what Esav is all about. There are many, many ways where these subtleties, where we are affected by the culture with these subtleties. The whole way that we interact between the genders, men and women, the way that we interact today on a regular basis, in an innocuous basis, in a way that we take for granted, is also unprecedented in the history of the world. It's never been like this. I've said this before, perhaps to all of you, but that just the mode of dress, we have a picture in a book that my son has of the World Series in 1912, something like that. Everybody's wearing a hat. Everybody. Men, women. Everybody's wearing a hat, and it's a black hat. Everybody's wearing a hat, because you wouldn't go outside without a hat. If you read books, you read storybooks, novels, whatever, storybooks, from that time, from the 50s, from the 40s. It's natural. You walk outside, you put a hat on. That's just the way people dressed. There's no such thing anymore. It doesn't exist. Except for some crazy fanatics. It doesn't exist anymore. The interaction between men and women is completely different than it used to be. The familiarity that we have with each other is something that is, as I said, unprecedented. It was unheard of in the early part of the 20th century, certainly in the 19th century, for men and women to be socially friendly. It just didn't happen. Not in an acceptable manner. It just didn't happen. It wasn't quote-unquote normal. Men socialized with men, and women socialized with women. That's the way it was. And today, it's just commonplace. Of course, men and women socialize together. That is an influence from the Edom around us. That's not something which is a Torah ideal. That's something which comes from the culture around us. The materialism, as I said before. Over these 8 days, the goal is, when you light the Hanukkah menorah, to focus on the lights, to look at the lights. You know that in previous generations, the tzaddikim would stare at the light of the menorah and just think, contemplate, where are we? Where are we going? What is life all about? And they would focus on that light. If we can just take a few minutes each night that we light the Hanukkah menorah to look at the light, stop what we're doing, take a look, and think about the purity of the Torah, and think about how we need to be pure and not be affected by the culture around us. Think about how we are affected by the culture around us, and how we can pull away from that, and how we can insulate ourselves and be focused only on the purity of the menorah. And in so doing, we can take our small step, because it's only going to be through each of us taking our small steps. It's not through any of us taking a huge step. It's through each of us taking a small step towards that huge light, that exponentially greater light, as the Gemara tells us. In the future, the moon will be as bright as the sun, and the sun will be 7 times 7 times 7, 7 to the third power, brighter than it is now. And that will be the time when the saviors will go up on the mountain of Zion to judge the mountain of Esav, and Hashem will have the kingdom. It will be His. Through the light of Hanukkah, we will bring about b'mheira v'yameinu, speedily and in our days, we will bring about that exponentially greater light, which will spell the defeat of Esav, and it will dispel, it will herald in the time of the Mashiach, and it will herald in the time when we are back in our rightful place, close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the world reaching its fruition.